Okay, well, welcome everybody. Thank you for joining this online webinar held at the International Inequalities Institute. So this is the first event of the III seminar series this academic year, and it's entitled, Why Do People Stay Poor? My name is Sanae Ohms. I'm a research officer at the III, and I will be chairing the event today. The speaker, Professor Oriana Bandiera, is a Sir Tony Atkinson Chair in Economics and Director of STICKERT here at the LSE. Professor Bandiera will be discussing different views of why people remain poor, emphasizing the poverty traps view, whereby differences in opportunities stem from differences in wealth. The event is scheduled to last until 1:30 today. So some housekeeping, some upcoming events at the III, which I have to announce before starting the presentation. So as part of the seminar series on migration, ethnicity and race on Tuesday, October 6th next week, there will be a presentation titled Hidden versus Revealed Attitude, a List Experiment on Support for Minorities in Ireland. This event will be followed by a public event on Thursday, October 8th at 5 p.m. During this event, Dr. Lucas Chanel from the Paris School of Economics will be discussing his new book entitled Unsustainable Inequalities, Social Justice and the Environment. So in the chat function, you will receive a link to see all the upcoming III events. And also there will be a link posted where you can sign up for the newsletter. So please sign up if you're interested. So we will now continue with the presentation. The presentation will last about 40 minutes, followed by a 20 minutes Q&A. If you have a question, please post them in the Q&A function and I will read them out at the end of the presentation. So I will now pass the word to Professor Bandiera. Thank you.
Hello. Hello, everybody. My name is Oriana Bandiera. I will present this recent work, which is co-authored with all the people that you see there on the screen. So the starting point for our work is to notice that people are not poor because they don't work. Most of the global poor are in employment. The problem is that the jobs that they have are not particularly good. So in order to understand why people stay poor, we need to understand the link between jobs and poverty, because by definition, the poor only have their labor. And numbers here are not very easy to get, although we are working on this, but the World Bank estimates that over 65% of workers are in low productivity informal jobs with low earning. And if you look at India, 98% of agricultural workers have casual jobs. Casual jobs, as we will see throughout the presentation, means that they do not have any guarantee of further employment. They work by the day and every day they look for work. Some days they find this, sometimes they don't. So the question that we ask in this paper is whether people stay poor because they're only able to do bad jobs, or whether they do bad jobs because they are poor. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg type of question. And it comes from a very long history, both in macroeconomics and microeconomics, mostly in theory, that looks at poverty traps. So the idea of poverty traps is that poverty breeds poverty. And there is a long history in macro and micro development theory, but there is no direct evidence. There are some empirical investigations that include calibrations with cross-country data and some structural approaches, so estimation of structural models. There are recent field experiments that relate to big push type of programs. And our paper fits in the latter category, because what we're going to do is that we're going to use a program that an NGO, BRAC, implemented in Bangladesh to test for the poverty trap. So let me start by explaining what we mean by poverty trap. people, two countries, whatever unit of observation you want to know about. And these are observed in two points, H and L. So we have two people at two equilibria. One is high, one is low. And the question that we ask is whether this difference is due to productivity differences. So these are two stable steady states of two different production functions. One person is more productive, hence ends up with a lot of capital. Another person is less productive, hence ends up with low capital. Or the same thing could be explained by something like this, which is a poverty trap. So how do we, it goes without saying that the answer to this question is key for policy. Because in the first type of world where the differences are due to productivity differences, people with the same productivity will reach the same steady state. So they will climb out of poverty no matter how low they start. In this type of world, anti-poverty policies can only support consumption, okay? So, you know, drip feeding will help people kind of climb the hill, but you can't do anything because the differences are due to differences in productivity. In the second world, in the poverty trap world, wealth at birth determines the steady state. So in that type of world, there is no way out without a big push. This is a world in which anti-poverty policies should support production or jobs. And a large increase in productive assets, could this be human capital or physical capital? But that's what's needed to get out of the poverty trap. So what we do in this paper is that we use a randomized controlled trial of a large asset transfer program in Bangladesh. And we trace the effect over 11 years to test directly for the presence of a poverty trap. We also estimate a structural model of occupational choice, which will allow us to put a number on the implied misallocation of labor. But I suspect I won't have time to go through that. So let me tell you a bit about the setting. This is Bangladesh. The area that we study is the northern districts, which are the poorest districts in the country. We collect a five-wave panel over 11 years. We start in 2007 with the census, which forms our sampling frame. Then we have the first wave, and then the program is implemented in 50% of the villages. And 50% are left as control up to 2013, when they're all treated. So what do we see over this period of time? The first is that other things equal, the poor stay poor. So if you look in control villages, there is no movement whatsoever. Okay? The second fact is that there is a hierarchy of jobs which is correlated with what the community defines as poor. So the poorest people are casually employed either in agriculture or in domestic services, they work as maids. And the richer are self-employed in livestock rearing and land cultivation. The third fact is that better jobs require productive assets. And productive assets, which are land and livestock, is really what sets apart the rich and poor in these villages. The value of assets owned by the rich households is 94 times the value of assets owned by the poor. And it's not just a matter of quantity of assets, it's also the type of assets that the rich own. So richer households tend to own more expensive and indivisible assets, such as cows. This is just a basic descriptive statistics. And what's to be noticed here is that apart from the extreme level of poverty, you see that among the ultra poor, which are the beneficiaries of this program, only 7% of them are literate. you can see the difference in assets is really what distinguishes the rich and poor more than anything else. Okay, so here is another way of seeing the same result. This is difference in assets 94 times. Consumption in comparison is much less. Now, occupational choice reflects this difference in asset ownership. Okay, in this figure, we have baseline productive assets on the horizontal axis and the share of hours spent in different occupations. You see that people who have no assets, so we're around the zero mark here, they mostly do casual work, either as maid or in agriculture. Whereas as you move to the right, so people who have more assets, they only do livestock rearing or land cultivation. This is what I was telling you earlier about more assets being more expensive assets. What the graph does, it plots the total value of productive assets on the horizontal axis and the share of assets of different types. So you see that people who have very little tend to have cheap assets like chickens. And as you move up, you get more bigger assets like goats, then you get some vehicles, and then as you move further to the right, you start getting cows and finally land. So as you get richer, you change the asset composition. And this is what also I was telling you earlier, this is in control villages over a period of 5 years. And these are the different classes, a baseline after 2 and after 5 years. And you see that there is no movement whatsoever. People who were poor at baseline stay poor after 5 years, and people who were rich stay rich. And finally, the fifth fact and what really got us started on this project is that if you look at the distribution of productive assets in both treatment and control at baseline, it's really bimodal. So there is a group of people who have very little, typically a few chickens, and then a second group of people who have a lot, like land and livestock. So let me tell you about how we run these tests for poverty traps. We used the ultra-poor program by BRAC. This is a program that was randomly allocated across areas. The beneficiaries were women, which were the poorest women in these villages. And the program transferred a cow and training on how to take care of the cow. Now, the defining feature of this program is that the transfer was huge relative to people's endowments at baseline. So the value of the asset was about 1 year of per capita consumption expenditure for these households. The typical microloan is about a fifth of that. Okay, so relative to the most standard development interventions, this was really big. Now, this is purely out of luck. The amount of the transfer was such that these people that were at the low mode in the distribution of assets, a baseline, got moved in the lowest density point. Okay? The reason why this is important is that if there is indeed a poverty trap, so if there is an unstable steady state, it must by definition be in that region, because an unstable steady state is such that nobody hangs about for very long. So out of luck, the transfer size was such that we take a bunch of people, like 4,000 people were treated, and they were moved straight in the middle at the lowest density point. So that's what happens right after the transfer. There is a mass of people which is moved from zero Tutu. So this is what we do in order to identify the poverty trap. We have this incredibly lucky coincidence that we observe people where the threshold should be, if there is one. So we look at the responses after they receive the transfer. That is, we go and identify whether there is a point such that people below that point lose the asset and people above escape poverty. It is important to notice that this doesn't happen by chance. So this is the distribution of shocks in control. So this is change in low productive assets over a 2-year period for control households when nothing happened. Okay. So, and this is the size, the red line is the size of the transfer that the program gives. You see that less than 5% of households experience a shock of that size by chance. And the reason this is important is that most investigations of poverty traps have been done with observational data, and they haven't found any evidence for poverty traps. But that's because observational data only give you shocks which are very small and therefore are incapable of bringing you from this point to this point, which is where you need to be to see whether indeed there are dynamics that are consistent with the poverty trap story. So our test is based on the intuition that poverty traps and differential productivity are observationally equivalent in steady state. Okay? So as I showed you in the figure before, we can't tell whether those two points have an underlying S-shaped production function or whether they have two parallel production functions, one higher than the other. However, despite the fact that they are observationally equivalent in steady state, they produce very different transition equations. That is, the response to the shock changes depending on whether it's a poverty trap story or whether it's a difference in productivity story. And in particular, a necessary condition for the poverty trap is that the transition equation, that is the relationship between capital at time t and capital at time t plus one, is not concave. Okay? So we can estimate this transition equation here, exploiting the fact that people have slightly different amounts of capital to start with. So if you go back to the figure, to the distribution, you see that these people who were treated at baseline, they had slightly different amount of capital. Okay, they all had very little, but there were some slight differences between them, which means that after the transfer, there is a distribution around the value of the transfer. So we can use that variation to see whether the amount of capital that you have after the transfer determines how much capital you have 4 years later. Notice that the identification is based on initial assets, which are extremely small relative to the transfer. Nevertheless, these are not randomized. So you might worry that they are correlated with other unobserved characteristic of the person, which also determines the future capital accumulation. So we provide two pieces of evidence in support of our identifying assumption. The first is that we have a control group, and we can use the response of the control group to their shocks to see whether people who start with a higher level of baseline capital are intrinsically gonna have a different response after 4 years. And the second thing that we do is that we use different sources of variation that proxy for either the higher saving ratio or higher productivity to exploit the difference within people who have exactly the same baseline level of capital. The idea there is that people with higher saving rates have a lower threshold. So we can look for different thresholds for people with exactly the same level of capital. So instead of using variation in capital as a source of identification, we use variation in saving potential. This will hopefully be clearer. If I could see you, I would probably see a lot of puzzled faces. I think it will become clearer soon, I hope. So let me tell you what we find. So remember that this is how the transition equation looks. If differences are due to productivity, it will look like this, like a concave production function. If differences are due to a poverty trap, it will look like this, an S shape. This again is the relationship between capital at time t and capital at t minus one, t plus one. Well, in the data, that's how it looks. This is a non-parametric estimate of baseline assets after the transfer in 2007 and productive assets, same stuff, in 2011. Okay? So if you estimate assets in 2011 over assets in 2007, this is the shape that you get, which doesn't look much like a concave function. We can identify this point, which is the point at which the transition equation cuts the 45 degree line from below. And that's our unstable steady state. And that's at a value which is slightly more than the transfer. I'll tell you what it compares to. You can estimate it in different ways. So that's a non-parametric estimate. If you fit a polynomial of degree 3, you get a very similar number. Now, we have to show that that point that we identified, that is the point where the transition equation cuts the 45 degree line from below, is indeed an unstable steady state. For it to be an unstable steady state, we have to observe that people above that point accumulate capital, and people below lose it. And that is the difference in delta K above and below K hat. So people below that point lose about 16% of their assets over a 4-year period, and people above, on average, gain 17%. Now, if you do exactly the same in control villages, this is what you get. There's no S shape here. It's a concave production function, and it meets the 45 degree line only at one point, which is exactly the low mode of the distribution of assets, which I showed you earlier. Notice that these two estimations are completely independent because the distribution of assets is taken at baseline, and this is estimated from the change in capital at baseline after 4 years, okay? And the only point that you get as a steady state is exactly the low mode. And this comes back to my point that with observational data, you can never identify poverty traps because by definition, the poverty trap is in a region of the space where there is an unstable steady state. And because it's unstable, you're not going to find anyone there unless something exogenous like our program places people there. Okay, so the difference, the 2.34, what does that correspond to? Well, it corresponds more or less to the value of a cart. It's between the value of a cart and the value of, I think, a plow. Okay. So it's not much. What this is telling you is that people who had a cart already and receive a cow on top of that managed to escape. Those who had nothing or less than a cart fall back into poverty. This is, again, for identification, comparing treatment and control villages, but you've seen already the figure in control villages. There is nothing like a poverty trap dynamic going on. This is further identification, but in the interest of time, because I know that I only have 5 minutes left, I want to show you the long-term results, because we follow these people unusually for 11 years. So I want to show you what happens after 11 years to the people who were above the threshold and those who were below. So this is our long run estimate. So this is productive assets. And this, all these graphs will plot the difference between people above and people below the threshold. Okay. And on the horizontal axis, we have the different survey waves. So this is 2 years later, this is 4 years later, 7 years later, and 11 years later. You see that the difference in productive assets grows over time. There is a change in the composition of assets. That is, most of the growth is driven by the fact that some of the people above the threshold managed to acquire land, whereas nobody below the threshold does. The average gap in consumption increases. Now, interestingly, if you look at the beginning, the gap in consumption is negative. That is, people who start below the threshold consume more to start with than those who are above. And that's because people who are above the threshold save at the beginning so that they can buy more assets later. It raises an interesting issue on whether we should use the standard poverty measures, that is the below 190 a day, to evaluate programs in the short run. Of course, in the long run, consumption and income will be very closely related, and that makes perfect sense. But in the process of adjustment to a new steady state, that is, had we evaluated this program in 2009, we would have concluded that the program actually works worse for people who have more assets. This is the gap in hours worked. It increases. This is total hours and hours devoted to livestock and land cultivation. It goes up over time. Now, the interesting thing here is that over 11 years, life cycle changes, right? So asset dynamics reflect two things, reflect convergence to the new steady state, but also aging. Below the threshold, both forces make you decumulate assets. Above the threshold, you know, the life cycle makes you lose assets, whereas the poverty dynamics make you draw assets. So we find, once you account for life cycle differences, we find much stronger effects on younger beneficiaries. Okay, and this is an illustration of that fact. So this is people below the threshold and above the threshold. And these are by median ages. And you see that the effect is driven by the younger people. Now, I don't have time to go through this, but what this model does is that it takes the results from the reduced form, it fits them in a model of occupational choice in order to calibrate the amount of misallocation. That is the fact how much we lose from the fact that these people are able to operate assets but they're not able to acquire assets. The last thing that I want to show you, so I'm not going to go through any of these unless there are questions about it. The last thing that I want to show you is a back of the envelope calculation that we did as to how big a transfer you need to get people out of the poverty trap. And this slide is titled quite simply that when you have a big problem, you need a big solution. So this is the BRAC transfer. It was about 80% of average per capita consumption, and it managed to lift 66%, so 2/3 of the households were above the threshold and escaped poverty. Now, if you compare this to common anti-poverty programs, you see that it's way bigger. So let me tell you what these lines are, and then I stop and we can discuss. So this is the standard microloan, which is $100 in per capita terms. So microfinance, as we know, has nearly no effect on long-term income. And this tells you why that happens. The transfer that microfinance give is simply too small to make a difference. This is the value of the second one is NREGA. So the value of the National Employment Guarantee Act. Then there is the second type of microloan at 200. And then all of these countries here are countries where a similar program was piloted. And you see that, well, we know from a recent paper by Abhijit Banerjee and co-authors that actually the country that had an effect most similar to Bangladesh was in India, in West Bengal, and that was also one of the most generous. Okay. So the bottom line, what I think we learned from all of this, is that poor people are not unable to take on more productive employment activities. They just lack the required capital. The misallocation, which you didn't see, suggests that the lack of opportunity prevents about 96% from engaging in their optimal occupation. Now, the existence of this poverty trap implies that only transfers that are large enough to push beneficiaries past the threshold will reduce poverty in the long run. Small transfers will only support consumption and will then bring people back to where they started. So the key policy conclusion is that to tackle persistent poverty, we need big push policies that tap into the talents of the poor rather than propping their consumption up from time to time. I think it's 40 minutes, so I stop here.
Oh, thank you very much, Oriana, for this very interesting talk. So actually, I wanted to say that the attendees are, there's a lot of people in this chat, much more than we could have fit in the seminar room. So I think that's one positive element of being able to do these things online. So we have 20 minutes for questions now. One thing that I forgot, if you type your question in the question box, please, at the Q&A forum, could you also post your name and affiliation? So I will start now with some of the questions that are already here. So the first question is a farming question. How does a poor family obtain the resources to feed a cow? Could this not bankrupt the family unless they sell the cow?
So the program was taking care of that in the sense that for the first 40 weeks, people were receiving a stipend that was compensating them from the fact that they had to give up their existing jobs and for the fact that they had to feed the cow. So the idea was to get them up and running to be able to do this. Then of course we see that, this is what the paper proves, that you need a minimum level of wealth for this to work, and that the very poorest families did end up losing the cow.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for that answer, Oriana. So the next question is from Eleanor Winpenny. Is there some effect of the type of transfer? For example, maybe transfer of a cow in training somehow encourages savings and development, while a cash transfer might not.
So I don't know the answer to that question yet, because in this program, there was only one type of transfer, that was cow with training. Now, we have another intervention which is modeled on this one in Pakistan, where people could choose whether to get this package of cow with training or cash. And everybody chose cash. But now the interesting thing is that with the cash, they want to buy a cow. So we'll see, we're waiting for the data for that for the data collection to be completed. And then we'll be able to answer that question.
Okay, thanks. So the next question is from Jibun from King's College London. So he gives compliments for the presentation and paper, first of all. And then he has a speculative question. So the SAC's Millennium Development Villages didn't appear to reduce poverty. Why do you think this was? Not enough money, not enough time to observe outcomes, or both?
So I think it's a bit of both. Clearly, you need a lot, you need a big push, because the threshold, if you believe this model, the threshold is really, really far from where you are. So a little push will only take you one third of the way, or, you know, a fourth of the way, and then you'll come back sliding. So the size is very important. The timing is also very important, because the way we measure poverty is by consumption. So any intervention that encourages savings, like these women here, could see the way out. So what they did once they saw the way out was to consume even less in order to save and buy more assets. So if we measure poverty by consumption in the short run, when people haven't reached the new steady state, we will end up underestimating the effect of the program. You're on mute.
Yes, thanks for the
response. This is the sentence of 2020.
So the next question is from Chico, director of the IAI.
Hi, Chico.
From the 96% occupational misallocation statistic, did you try to estimate a dollar amount of the aggregate income lost from unequal opportunity, say as a percentage of village output?
Yes, we did. And that's where it goes. So the total value of the misallocation is about 15 million per year. The cost of the transfer that's needed to bring everybody above the threshold is at 1 million, one off. So it seems a very good deal. And we're now looking, actually this, if anything, is an underestimate of the effect of the program, because this only counts the extra earnings that the woman can have by tending a cow instead of being a maid. But the program also has impact on their children. So we're putting together an evaluation that looks at the life cycle of a child and shows how having more wealth at birth gives you better health, so anthropometrics, you're taller, and then makes you more likely to go to school, to stay in school for longer, and eventually, as you enter the labor market, makes you more likely to get a good job. So that's coming soon. This 15 million estimate does not take that into account.
Okay, thanks. I will now continue with the next question from Dina Rodriguez, MSc grad from Nova SBE. If I understood correctly, treatment and control individuals were not randomized. They were allocated based on small variations in savings. Could you kindly clarify the randomization rule and why there's no endogeneity problems?
sorry, apologies for that. Treatment and control were randomized. The randomization was done at the BRAC office level. So there were 40 offices that were dealing with 1,300 villages, and half of them were randomized into treatment and the other half were randomized into control. For the evaluation of the program, that's what we use. We use the treatment and the control randomized. What we do in this paper is slightly different. We want to see for a given level of transfer, so people who got the same transfer in treatment villages, did they respond differently depending on the level of wealth? And while wealth, a baseline, is of course not exogenous, the variation in wealth is really tiny relative to the size of the transfer. Moreover, we have different techniques to show that the variation is not coming from any endogenous component, but it's actually coming from being to the right or the left of the threshold.
Thanks. So the next question is from Eleanor Power, assistant professor at the Department of Methodology at the LSE. How specific do you think these findings are to Bangladesh and the particular livelihoods there?
So this is a very interesting question, one that we have to tackle all the time. Now, I could show you, well, I think it's take too long. So I've been collecting data on from the DHS and the IPUNS on countries in the same region. And when we look at different countries in that region, and we try to plot this figure here, the bimodality, which is the figure that starts us all on this, we get exactly the same. So everywhere you look in this region, you get a distribution of assets, which is bimodal, which is indicative of poverty traps. So I don't think it's specific to Bangladesh. Of course, this, the assets that you need to get out of the trap is specific to that simple rural economy. But if you ask me, are there poverty traps in England? I would say that yes, there are. Of course, we can't give people cows. We should give people human capital because that's a relevant asset.
So I will continue with the next question. So this question is from Salvatore Morelli from the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality and University of Roma III. He also thanks you a lot for the talk. His question is, do you observe any effects on the market prices of the assets following the transfer?
So that's a very good question, and one that we were very worried about. That's why we collected data on households at different classes, different wealth classes, and we collected data on prices as well. Now, there is no change in the price of cows or the price of milk. And that can be reconciled, noting that the number of cows that were transferred were a tiny fraction of the total stock of cows in the village. Because if you take large landowners, they have herds in the 50s or hundreds. And the total number of cows that were transferred in every village was 7, because there were 7 beneficiaries per village. So that's not surprising that, you know, these women taking on cow rearing, they do it at such scale that doesn't affect the market price. What we do find general equilibrium effects is on the wages for casual labor, which we haven't shown here because the purpose of this paper is not to evaluate the program. But if you look at our evaluation, what we see is that these beneficiaries, they stop working as casual workers and they start rearing cows. But because they account for the bulk of the labor supply of casual jobs, the wage goes up. So there is an additional benefit here to those who remain in casual work, and of course a cost for employers.
So Chico asks, what about the price of land?
Now, the movements in land are very small. It's only by year 11 that a few people managed to acquire land. So we, to be fair, we haven't looked at it because we only saw now, like after 11 years, that there was an effect, but I doubt that there will be a difference. So to be clear, the cows were transferred in 2007. We see people accumulating more and more cows all the way through 2009, 11, and so on. We only see an uptick in land ownership in the very last wave. And again, the amount of land that they own is very small. So I don't think that there is enough pressure, but that's clearly something that we should check.
I received one more question from Carolina Lozano. In your opinion, would this kind of transfer be a better option compared to programs that provide a transfer based on human capital investment requirements?
Not necessarily. It depends who you're dealing with. So if you're dealing with a young population that's about to enter the labor market, and in an area where there is a return to skill, that is where they can use the human capital, I would say that human capital is probably a better investment. But the key point of this paper is not as much on the type of transfer, but on the size of the same. Because these are transfers that nobody can afford on their own. Because no bank, no money lender will ever lend you 1 year worth of income. So whether you give human capital or physical capital, as in this case, it has to be enough. And that's what sets apart this program from many other poverty reduction programs. It's just the sheer magnitude of the transfer.
So apart from that, I didn't receive any more questions for today's sessions. So I will then, as chair, close the session. So I would like to thank Oriana very much for this great talk, and thank the audience for all of the very interesting questions that were asked. And we hope to see you again at another IAI seminar. Thank you so very much. Bye. Bye.